This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Since China is hell-bent on capturing Africa as a business destination, so Trump will come to Africa not so much because he really cares about Africa, but because he's coming to counter Chinese influence on the African soil.
That's Edward Gitua, professor of international relations at Strathmore University in Kenya, on Africa being a big market, playing a big role in the global economy. Details coming up. Also, the United Nations says over 1 million people have now fled the Sudanese war into neighboring South Sudan. And Gabon voter registration moves slowly ahead of this year's election. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As President Donald Trump assumes power, African analysts weigh in on what governing for the second-term presidency may feel like for the continent compared with his first term. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Madialo reports.
Donald Trump's first term included the launch of some initiatives for Africa. However, many people remember him for referring to the continent using degrading language. Edgar Githua is a professor of international relations at Strathmore University in Kenya.
What he called Africa a shithole, excuse my French.
Estimated at over 1 billion people, Africa's population is growing fast and expected to reach 2.5 billion by 2050, according to various estimates. It's a big market that plays a key role in the global economy, Githua says, and in terms of business and trade, Trump may be interested in Africa, but only because of the inroads China has made here.
Since China is hell-bent on capturing Africa as a business destination, so Trump will come to Africa not so much because he really cares about Africa, but because he's coming to counter Chinese influence on the African soil. So that fight, that proxy war, that geopolitical repositioning, in my view, is what could probably benefit Africa.
But Trump's first term saw the birth of initiatives such as Prosper Africa, aimed at facilitating economic engagement between the U.S. and African nations. Since its launch in 2019, the U.S. has helped close nearly 3,000 deals across 49 countries for a value of more than $120 billion, according to figures shared on the initiative's website. While every American president establishes his own policy, many programs, including Prosper Africa, AGOA, or the African Growth and Opportunity Act, and PEPFAR, or the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, continue beyond the end of president's terms because they have solid bipartisan support in Congress. No matter who's in power in Washington, countries need to redefine what they want and how they want to work with the new administration, Rwandan economic analyst Teddy Kaberuka tells VOA. And while Trump's America First policy may suggest more focus on America, some emerging economies in Africa still can benefit, he says.
Because if he is focused on boosting the domestic production, obviously the U.S. will import a lot of raw material from all over the world, and most likely in Africa, being in minerals, being in agriculture.
Kaberuka says the Ukraine war has hurt African economies, especially the grain supply disruption it caused, triggering a shortage of about 30 million metric tons of grain in Africa in the first year of the war alone, according to the Atlantic Council, a policy research organization based in Washington. He says Trump didn't engage in wars during his first term and complimented the president-elect for publicly stating he aimed to help end the Ukraine war shortly after he takes office.
As an African, as someone who have that overview on the global economy, on African economy, the war we are facing, their consequences, I could say people like me were excited because, you know, from the experience, you know, the Trump administration, there were less wars.
In the Sahel, a region recently plagued by coups, the U.S. closed two military bases and withdrew from Niger last year, at the request of a junta that staged a coup the prior year. Their presence, U.S. officials said, was to help the region's counterterrorism efforts. analyst Rita Liamuri, who's done field work in the Sahel Lake Chad Basin, is a senior fellow at the Policy Center for the New South, a Moroccan-based policy research firm in Washington.
We are seeing increasingly this narrative and this perception that is changing toward the West and accusing the West of being one of the problems why Africa has not seen significant economic development. The priority for the Trump administration to find ways to keep a positive image toward the U.S. and avoid what is currently happening, for example, to France in Francophone Africa.
Liamuri says he doesn't think the Sahel will be a priority for this new administration, but if that was to be, what happened in Niger should be a lesson.
It's a message to the U.S. Going forward to not take things for granted. And I think Niger have been a reliable partner in the region, but this decision shows that it doesn't mean that it's guaranteed that the partnership is going to be forever.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Maniat Retker is South Sudanese businessman and social justice activist who came to Washington to watch the inauguration of President Donald Trump. He is here with me in the studio. Welcome to African News Tonight, Manian.
Thank you for having me.
So, talk to us about your experience observing the inauguration here in Washington, D.C.
I mean, the experience has been so excited so far because I was just trying to meet many people. The idea that I was invited was very exciting for me, and I feel, you know, honored to be part of this movement of just being in D.C., meeting new people, and I mean, there's con and pro, all that stuff are in there, but it's a mixed in feeling. I just get excited to meet different people, attend a lot of different events and different faces all over the world. So I'm excited to be in Washington, D.C.
So who invited you?
It's the Trump team, basically. It's Alex Padilla. He's a senator from California. These are the team
sponsored
that...
Yeah. And basically, what is your assessment of the main person, President Trump?
I think so far he's saying, I mean, we know what is coming and he say what he's going to do. And so it's not like we didn't know all along what's going to happen. So he's doing what he say he's going to do. And you know, so far it's a mix of feeling when it comes to migration, because in the background, I'm also a migrant and I've been living here and advocate for refugee for over decades and human rights issues and things that I care about. So there need to be policy that put in place that help people at the same time. So, but I'm very excited just to be here.
And you said you met a lot of people. You congregated with groups. What do you tell them about your own country, South Sudan?
I think South Sudan need a lot of more American support and more help when it comes to like creating a sub policy within the country. I think the country has been, you know, like South Sudan is only like a younger nation on the planet. So there's no proper setup that was put together. And right now, you know, the world economics is also hurting the younger nations. All of us are, you know, struggling in this term of economic challenges that we are facing in South Sudan right now.
And as a social activist, a justice activist and a businessman, what do you actually take from this experience back to Juba, to South Sudan?
I think just seeing how the world is moving and how the country can benefit from America, I think this is something that we could take and use as a way to follow the example of, you know, like just modeling the democracy here that we are having. And you know, like just be, you know, we need to be patient with democracy. It doesn't come overnight. It's a long overdue. It's a long things, you know. Take America many, many, many years, over 200, to get where they need to get. So South Sudan will also take a long time to get where they need to be.
And lastly, how are things in Juba? Things were kind of dicey a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I think relatively, I mean, you can say South Sudan is still at the fees right now, relatively. And so, you know, it's like I think we text this as improving forward to, you know, to the country can, you know, can move up from these challenges that it's facing.
Manyat Redkar, South Sudanese businessman and social justice activist who came to Washington to watch the inauguration of President Donald Trump. Thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
The United Nations says more than 1 million people have fled the Sudanese war into neighboring South Sudan. The French news agency AFP reports that tens of thousands have been killed and more than 12 million forced from their homes since conflict erupted between Sudan's army and rival paramilitary group in April 2023. New data released yesterday shows more than 770,000 people have fled through the Jodha border crossing in the last 21 months. At the same time, tens of thousands more have crossed into South Sudan elsewhere, bringing the total to more than 1 million. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says most of the 1 million people crossing the border are South Sudanese nationals who previously fled from civil war in the world's newest country. A UN statement warns that resources in South Sudan, such as health care, water, and shelter, have become dangerously overstretched. Civilians in Gabon are being encouraged this month to register to take part as voters in presidential elections scheduled for August. The planned elections are envisioned to end a 2-year transition to civilian rule. Voter registration began January 2nd and is due to conclude at the end of the month. Gabon's political opposition says voter registration has not been as robust as expected because citizens think transitional president General Brice Clotaire Ilugui Nguema wants to confiscate power, assertions that Nguema denies. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Ainsi, parmi les mesures phares, la révision des mécanismes d'identification des électeurs.
Gabon State Television reminds civilians that they have up to January 31 to enroll and be eligible to vote in the nation's presidential elections expected in August 2025, as ordered by transitional president General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema. The elections are part of a plan for a return to constitutional order after an August 30, 2023 coup that ousted longtime President Ali Bongo Ondimba. Gabon officials say at least 300,000 new voters who have either reached the legal voting age of 18 or who are not yet registered are expected to be added to the 860,000 or so civilians that registered as part of Gabon's November 16, 2024 constitutional referendum and whose names are already in the elections database. This week, officials of the Central African nation said sino-state functionaries were deployed to encourage civilians to register before the January 31 deadline. Ministers dispatched to towns and villages this week are expected to work with voter enrollment teams and make sure civilians are formally registered as voters so they can participate in the August elections and cast ballots. But Gabon's opposition and civil society groups say civilians are not heeding calls by government officials to register because they are not sure Nguema is ready to hand power to civilian rule. Cyril Bisengu is the deputy coordinator of Yes Volunteers, a group created in 2024 to encourage civilians to take part in Gabon's electoral process.
Nous avons au niveau de notre plateforme initié une opération que nous appelons d'inscrit.
Bisengu says he is not sure that before the ongoing registration of voters ends on January 31, at least 300,000 new voters would have registered as Gabon's government expects. He says many young people, yes, volunteers contacted to register, say they are not sure about transitional ruler Nguema's willingness to hand power to civilians. Bisengo spoke on Gabon's state TV on Tuesday. Jean-Remy Yama is the leader of Unitary Dynamics, one of Gabon's leading worker trade unions and member of Gabon's Senate, appointed by Nguema. He also expressed skepticism.
Je déplore tout simplement qu'on ait manqué l'occasion de faire
un... Yama says if Nguema truly wants to hand power to civilian rule, he should have allowed Gabon's parliament and Senate that voted a new electoral code on Monday to set up an independent elections management body that will assure free, fair and transparent elections. He says by asking a minister appointed by transitional rulers to register voters and organize elections instead of creating an independent electoral commission to organize the polls, Nguema is indicating that he wants to confiscate power. Gabon's constitution, voted in a November 16 referendum to lay the groundwork for elections, bars transitional government members from running in the 2025 presidential polls, but permits Nguema to run for president. Nguema has not said whether he will be a candidate, and the transitional government refutes claims the military leader is planning to maintain power. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Celebrations erupted in many cities after the United States, Egypt, and Qatar announced a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas to end more than 15 months of fighting in Gaza. The agreement includes the release of hostages taken by Hamas in return for releasing Palestinians jailed in Israel. But some experts are skeptical about the future of the deal. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi has the details.
Some Middle East experts say implementing the ceasefire agreement between Hamas and Israel will be day by day, as it is designed to be carried out in phases. The six-week deal went into effect on Sunday, with Hamas beginning the gradual release of hostages it captured in 2023 and Israel freeing some Palestinians from its prisons. Stephen A. Cook is a senior fellow of Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
There are a whole host of questions, and I think most important among those is what the Israeli government has said over and over again, that it will not fully withdraw from the Gaza Strip, meaning that it would stay in the Netzarim corridor, this east-west axis that bisects the Gaza Strip, from which the Israelis have been launching military operations, and importantly, on the Philadelphia corridor, which is right on the Gaza-Egypt border.
Cook was speaking during a recent webinar with the Council on Foreign Relations, a policy research organization in New York. Cook said the agreement is complicated as the first phase is 6 weeks long and negotiations will start for the second phase in about 2 weeks. Since those talks will be based on how well each side thinks the other has performed, he questions the chances of success for the second phase.
Phase two is about ending the conflict permanently. And of course, as I alluded to, there are serious questions and clearly opponents to a ceasefire, both within Israel as well as among the Palestinians. So I'm somewhat skeptical that this is going to move from a stage one to a stage two to a permanent end of the conflict.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has said Israel retains the right to resume the war in Gaza should negotiations for the second phase prove futile. Elliot Abrams is a senior fellow of Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
It's very interesting that one of the initial Hamas demands was an end to the war. Israel has not said that, isn't saying that, and, you know, there's a perfectly reasonable possibility that 1 or 6, 8 months from now, they will be back in Gaza.
Abrams also was speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations. While U.S. President Donald Trump has called for peace in Gaza and advocated for the ceasefire, Abrams says he doesn't think renewed fighting will be a prime concern for the Trump administration. Abrams said Trump's priority is to free the hostages Hamas holds and that later fighting won't be a top item for the administration. World leaders have issued statements celebrating the ceasefire agreement, but there has been little talk on resolving the core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and what the future looks like for Palestinians in the war-torn strip. The ceasefire deal is a milestone in the war that began in October 2023 when Hamas fighters from Gaza attacked Israel, killing about 1,200 people and taking around 250 hostages. Israel responded with an assault that destroyed much of Gaza's infrastructure, killed nearly 50,000 Palestinians, and displaced almost all of Gaza's 2 million residents. Mohammed Chinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Tanzania's main opposition party has chosen a new leader ahead of general elections due in October. Today, Freeman Mbowe, who has been Chadema chairman for 2 decades, congratulated his successor, former Deputy Tundu Lissu. The change comes amid a crackdown on the opposition in the Eastern African country, as well as internal divisions in the Chadema party that analysts say could weaken its election chances. A lawyer by profession, Lissu served as an MP from 2010 to 2017 when he survived an assassination attempt. He was also Chadema's presidential candidate in the last general election in 2020. Dozens of American citizens and residents are unjustly held around the world. If confirmed as President Donald Trump's pick for hostage envoy, Adam Boholer will be tasked with freeing them. Christina Caicedo has the story.
He is a Wharton School alumnus, the founder and managing partner of the healthcare investment firm Rubicon, and a Middle East expert. And if Adam Boholer is confirmed by the U.S. Senate, he will become President-elect Donald Trump's pick as the special envoy for hostage affairs with the personal rank of ambassador. The 45-year-old Boholer is a familiar face in the U.S. government. He served in the last Trump administration, including during the coronavirus pandemic, and was the first chief executive officer of the International Development Finance Corporation. In that role, Boholer accompanied former White House senior advisor Jared Kushner on diplomatic travels. Boholer was also part of the Abraham Accords, helping the negotiating team normalize relations between Israel and several Arab states. If approved by Congress, Boholer will lead the Office of the Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, which works with the government and the private sector to secure the release of American-held hostage or wrongfully detained abroad. In interviews, Boholer has talked about the tough approach the new Trump administration will take, saying countries need to free U.S. hostages or, quote, we're going to take action. Russia, China, Cuba, and Afghanistan are among the countries where many American citizens and residents are held by state or non-state actors, says the Foley Foundation. Nonprofit organizations like Hostage Aid Worldwide welcome Trump's pick and say a holistic approach is needed. Hostage Aid Worldwide is currently on the ground in Syria looking for Austin Tice, a former Marine-turned-freelance journalist who has been held for over 12 years. A main ask of nonprofits to the Special Hostage Envoy is better communications with families and civil society partners on the process of bringing Americans safely back home. Christina Caicedo Smith, VOA News.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Mokabilia Baro, and our engineer, Bob Bass, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.